This is John Udell. How are you?
Hey, good. Thanks.
Just so you know, I find myself talking to an awful lot of people in Canada recently.
Oh, it's the Canadian Mafia trying to take over the world.
Evidently so, yeah. So you're in Toronto, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
I forget where I found the pointer to the talk that you gave at the Boston. Was that the SIGCHI group?
Yeah, it was this local SIGCHI chapter, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So in any event, there you were, and you were talking about this book, Sketching User Experiences, which is, although I haven't seen it yet, but I assume that your talk was a good representation of at least part of what's in the book.
Yeah.
The takeaway phrase for me is design thinking. I like that a lot. I heard that somewhere else recently as well.
It's not a new term, but it's not a term that is in general use. And I tend to like it in the following sense, that everybody gets into these conversations and debates about what is design. And I think that's kind of like one of these black holes that just sucks you in and you never get out of it. Just swirl around in that kind of vortex. And
yeah.
Whereas design thinking leads us to not trying to define what design is, but rather just talking about what designers do. And the point about it is to say, what do designers do that's different than most other professions, such as, for example, people from the business community or people from, let's say, with a software engineering or a technical background?
For you, in practice, design has been in the domain, I gather, of software and in particular of user interfaces to software. Is that correct?
Yeah. But I take the term interface pretty broadly, because I've always designed both hardware and software.
Okay.
That doesn't mean I'm a hardware engineer, but I'm not illiterate in the field. If you take, let's just even take a mobile phone or take an Xbox or a Zune, the line between where hardware stops and software begins in terms of the user interface is very blurred in terms of what is it that defines the interface.
Mm-hmm. And nowadays, services as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you can even go further and say it's not just the interface with the device, but rather the interface the device enables me to have with the larger organization, or in the case of an Xbox, the interface with the game controller. That's one level, and it's even deeper in terms of what's going on in the game, but it's even deeper in terms of if it's a multiplayer game and there's people, it's my interface with them. If I think about it, I'm interfacing with the other player as opposed to the thing in my hand or even the screen in front of me.
Yeah. So one of your primary principles is that the act of sketching is fundamental to all design. And so you ask the question, what is it like to sketch a user experience? What tools do we have available to do that sketching? And what is that, you know, what is that process like? And one of your strong biases actually is against the kinds of, I guess you would say, prototyping tools that we have reflexively tended to apply to this process, because, you know, whether it's a flash mock-up or some other sort of more completely realized prototype, your argument is that that technology of sketching is too cumbersome and too heavyweight to meet the need, because the need is to be able to have lots of disposable, quick ideas up front from which you can then distill out the ones that you want to more formally prototype and build.
Right. So the attitude about sketching is, again, it's another way that I use to avoid defining what is design, but rather, again, what do designers do.
Mm-hmm.
And sketching is, I guess, the making of sketches, but that isn't in itself design, but it's one of the primary activities that leads to design thinking. And the sketch is the way that you open up a conversation, you open up a dialogue between you and the sketch, between you and other people by means of the sketch, or looking at multiple sketches, even amongst the sketches themselves, to actually bring you to insights about relationships and how what other alternatives might exist.
Yeah.
That all might sound kind of soft, but the reality is that design is as much about getting the right design as getting the design right. And what passes for design in many cases is actually more like usability engineering, where you're trying to refine a design that you've along a trajectory. So you go along this path and you iteratively go through and keep doing version after version, but along a certain path, as mm-hmm. opposed to exploring five really different paths simultaneously to try and figure out which is the best one or what's the one you really want to go. And in fact, of those five, it may turn out that none of the five are the one you want, and they just are the catalyst that trigger an insight that will lead you to number six.
So I listened to the talk that you gave, and that really hit home for me, because at one time I was involved in the design of a software-based service, and I had a very strong idea about what I thought it should be.
Yeah.
And so I effectively went straight to what you would call a prototype. It was really an HTML mockup. You could drive through and get a reasonable sense of what it was going to be like, which was useful for giving a sense of a pretty deep sense of what the interaction was going to be. But to your point, it turned out in some ways to be the wrong design. And so what I failed to do was deliver, as you would say, five or more very different ideas up front that could be discussed and decided on. But so you've got lots of ideas about how in very lightweight and low-tech ways it is possible to do more with less in terms of paper sketches, or in terms of you have some great stories about really low-tech hardware mock-ups, like the one where somebody used a magnet to guide a pin. And that was a way of mocking up a cursor on a device, right? Without really writing any code or going into any significant amount of engineering work. You're actually pretty pessimistic then about the possibility of bringing tools of simulation into this equation, at least for now.
I'm very cautious about bringing in software tools, because there certainly are software tools that can be used, and as you go down, the path from sketching to prototyping is a continuum. And as you start to move along that continuum, increasingly you're going to start bringing in more powerful tools. But the rule of thumb should be always use the simplest and cheapest and fastest tool you can, because no matter what better fidelity you get by using a more sophisticated tool, the benefits almost never outweigh the cost in terms of the ideas that you're not going to be able to explore because of pursuing the fidelity of that one idea.
Right.
The more powerful the tools are, generally the more specific they are. So there are things like GUI builders that have been around for years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they make it really easy to explore things. And you can even explore them where you've got hand-drawn sort of sketches on the front end so they look sketch-like and so on and so forth. And I've even been involved back in the mid-80s of making interactive tools where you literally could draw the interface and then actually start to have it sort of run.
Yeah.
And knock things off. And they work fantastically well within the repertoire of interface styles and interface widgets and interface ideas that whoever built the tool had anticipated.
Right, right.
And so you can work and do novel things and well-crafted things within the vocabulary of those tools, but they actually, because they're so efficient and so on, they exhibit one of the most powerful biases of human behavior, and that is we follow the path of least resistance. We'll do what's easy, you know. And so they tend to bias us towards certain solutions, and therefore away from solutions that we might have otherwise had, or might in fact be far better. But they aren't. They simply aren't suggested by or made easy to access by the particular toolkit you're using. And that's why I'm really concerned. And there's some other things that are just, I believe, are simply wrong. And the biggest mistake that I see people doing over and over and over again is they immediately start designing sort of realistic-looking screen mock-ups. And they think they're doing storyboards, and they're basically doing screen mock-ups that you can't, if you look at them, they look like photographs because they've done them in Illustrator and Photoshop. They look just like the real thing, like a finished product. And any manager or anybody looking at that is going to say, wow, that looks really great, because they don't see it in action. They don't know how it behaves. They don't know what other alternatives there might be. And then all of a sudden they say, oh, so you're finished. And in fact, you've just started. It's your very first concept piece, but you drew it as if it looked like it was finished. And guess what? People will think it's finished. And then a month later, you have something that looks just as good in terms of fidelity. And they'll say, well, what have you been doing for the last month?
I like that point. And in particular, I like the point that you take from architectural drawing, where the convention is in what is in fact a sketch to show lines crossing rather than sharply joining at corners, and as a piece of vocabulary that says this is not to be taken as final, it is to be taken as speculative. What I wonder about, though, is when what we're doing is so intimately connected to movement and to flow and to sequence, then it does seem to be an area that begs for some application of animation or video or live interaction in order to really convey what the experience is going to be, whether it's hardware, software, or a combination of those things.
Absolutely. And that's a case where then we can sort of say, well, what would constitute reasonable tools for sketching animation? So when you do film and animation, so I spent a long time in the film business, what you do before you go and do a complex animation and render it out all beautifully in a Toy Story kind of way is you do what's called a pencil test.
Mm-hmm.
And another term used in filmmaking is you make an animatic. And
mm-hmm.
so they basically are sketches of the sequence, so you can just sort of get the feel. George Lucas, for example, when he was planning in the first three Star Wars movies, I don't mean in series 1, 2, and 3, but actually so 4, 5, and 6, I think it was number 4. There's this whole dogfight of X-Fighters and so on and so forth and so on and so forth. Well, all he used there in terms of doing an animatic and trying to get the flow and the feel is he just got World War I dogfight footage and cut that and said, that's how I want it to feel. And then he just did some sketches on paper of what the different craft would look like. And they literally just motion capped. They followed the motion of the real footage of World War I planes
mm-hmm.
and did a substitution of the X-Fighters and stuff like that, and that's what they ended up with. I saw on episode 1, so the fourth one made, there's that famous pod race scene where they're going around in the Colosseum type of thing. Well, the way that he sketched that out initially was he was intercutting footage from Ben-Hur, from the chariot race in Ben-Hur, with NASCAR footage. And so the crashes were NASCAR crashes. And you're sitting there watching this, and all of a sudden you see a chariot with a Roman in it go around the corner, and coming back at the other side is a modern stock car. You know, and absolutely it works because of just getting the pre-visualization.
How would you map that strategy, though, onto the design of a software interface?
You fake it. You use whatever you can to fake it. So the second half of my book is all about how to fake it. The most famous way is through example that it is using a Wizard of Oz technique, right? And the story goes as follows, that as long as Toto, the dog, doesn't pull the curtain back to reveal the Wizard of Oz to be a fraud,
mm-hmm.
then all of Dorothy's reactions are valid, psychologically, sociologically, anthropologically, they're just real.
Yeah.
The best example of using, and so we just have to become good wizards.
Well, so how would you wizard, for example, the office ribbon? If you had that idea,
yeah.
You had the idea for the office ribbon, and now you don't want to invest any engineering resources yet. You just want to test out the idea, but you want to give people a sense of what it's like to interact with that thing. How would you be the man behind the curtain to give people that interactive sense of what that would be like?
Okay, so for the ribbon, what you would do is you'd do what's called paper prototyping and to begin with, and you just basically have hand-rendered versions.
Yeah.
And for all the pull-down menus and all the other objects, you'd have post-it notes and other things like that. And so when somebody comes with a pencil and pretends it's their stylus and they click on something, you just stick down a post-it note that's cut out to, you anticipate all the things that they're going to do because you carefully crafted what you asked them to do.
Okay.
And just stop them down, pull them away. Now that will give you the flow, the sequencing. It will not give you the dynamics, like in terms of response time and
right.
so forth.
Right.
To show that type of thing, I would use exactly the same things, photograph them, photograph people using, and then make a really rough pencil test so I could play back on video what I think the timing has to be to show it in real time and have it work that way.
Okay.
And so it's a combination of techniques where you can go through, and each one, none of the techniques are going to be sufficient on their own. My favorite example of the Wizard of Oz was simply back in the early 80s when IBM was trying to figure out whether making a speech-activated, like a dictating word processor that you could dictate to a word processor rather than type to it, and that had perfect speech recognition and everything like that.
Right, and they put a guy on the other end of the...
And they literally just put somebody at the other end of the microphone with a set of headphones who was a court reporter
yeah.
who could type like the wind, and then it appeared on the screen, and Bob's your uncle, it worked, and they did it overnight, and it wasn't a line of code. And that way they could find out, oh, well, actually, the problem isn't speech recognition. The problem is people can't talk the way they write.
Yeah.
And then once you've got it, how do you do revisions and all that sort of stuff? And then it becomes really, really hard. And so you can get by some of these initial assumptions and realize, oh, that wasn't quite right, or that was brilliant. The part I didn't expect was brilliant, and the part I thought was going to be rotten was, or that I thought was going to be great is rotten, and so on. And it's those types of rapid learning and discovery that are really important.
What I like a lot about the approach that you outline is the eclectic nature of it. So you're very aggressively low-tech, but you're also very multidisciplinary and willing to see how lots of different strategies can and should be combined. And I think that that's, well, I tend to think that way myself. It's a fairly natural thing for me. I think it's probably a hard thing for maybe many people because there is a preference to want to favor a single strategy or a single toolkit.
Well, the thing is that I put myself through graduate school and I know how much it costs to do a graduate course in computer science, for example. And if you've done that and you've worked really hard, damn it, I'm going to use it. That's the natural tendency.
Yeah.
In fact, that's exactly the wrong tendency.
Yeah.
In fact, the better way to think about it, if from my value system, is that, yeah, damn it, if it was that expensive, don't waste it. use it where it really counts, and so save your heavy gun, save that great ammunition that you work so hard to accumulate for where it's going to have most effect. So don't waste it on an idea that you're not sure, and where you've never even given a chance to find out if you have a better one. The other part is there's a sort of a it's not just about the design of the products, but the design of the team that designs the products. If everybody on the team has the same background, then you have a cultural bias that's going to just really reinforce this, let's do it the way we've done it before, because mm-hmm. we know it works, we're under a deadline, and we don't have time to do this, let's just get down, because hell, we know from every project we've done that we always have a rush at the end, we're going to have to drop features, and we got to save time for all the fixing the bugs. Instead of sort of saying, oh, well, actually, if we took it in a really different way, we'd finish early and there wouldn't be any bugs. That's a little overly optimistic. But that's not going to be the problem. And the way around that is the saying, you use the word multidisciplinary, if I remember correctly, but it's not just having an individual who is multidisciplinary. It's the whole team.
Mm-hmm.
If the whole thing here is about experience design, then there's probably going to be a really good correlation between the quality of the end product's experience and the breadth of the collective experience in different things mm-hmm. that the design team brings to it. And so the more diversity in terms of perspective, even just with you ride horses and I ride mountain bikes and somebody else was a ham radio operator and someone else flies model airplanes and someone else happens to be a poet, whatever. Those things, that type of diversity brings a breadth of experience, a past experience that can serve as the foundation for likely, in all probability, a much richer set of ideas that are on the table to be considered, evaluated, and most of which rejected, but for good reason, not because we never thought of them in the first place. And that elimination by conscious decision as opposed to not having thought of them is what concerns me the most, because among the things that we never thought of often are the best ideas.
So there's a meme floating around, which I in many ways do subscribe to, although I think probably based on listening to your talk, you don't. And that's the notion of people who use the stuff are themselves, in a way, importantly, co-creators or co-designers. Because, in fact, at the end of the day, that breadth of experience ultimately resides with those people because there are so many more of them.
Yeah, so there's a really heated dialogue going on around that very issue.
Yeah.
On the one extreme, sort of in the corner in the red trunks, is designer as God, the designer who I'm the designer, damn it, and you're not, and
yeah.
I know what's good for you. And the other extreme says that everybody's a designer and we're all created equal, and in fact the people who are the end users know the most about it, so let them design it. And I think that things get softened, and that it's a bogus argument, and I try not to get sucked into it, because the reality is that, first of all, yes, everyone in that whole continuum could have a really valuable and important role to play in the eventual design, but we are not all designers in the capital D design as I think of it, which is different than saying we can all contribute to the design. That doesn't make us all designers.
Yeah, I think it's important to qualify what the different points along the continuum are, because I agree that that word has a different meaning depending on where you are on that continuum. But I'll just bring in, so one of the, I think, important arguments that's being made here is by Eric Von Hippel at MIT, and it's in his book Democratizing Innovation and some other things that he's done as well. But, you know, the general idea being that what he calls the lead users are just by virtue of their use of products and services are, to the extent that they can, modifying those products and services as they use them. And it is the intent, which you can read in those modifications, which is providing, if you look for it, important clues about how to respond in a next iteration of the product or service. And he goes beyond that to make what I think is the sort of really important point, which is that if you agree that that's how things tend to work, then part of the task of the designer goes beyond delivering the best incarnation of the product or service, but also anticipates that interaction and provides for it, right? Provides a way to make the thing that is delivered into their hands malleable by them in the right ways, where the right ways would be the ways that enable them to express the intent to modify, and that intent is the result of needs that they're experiencing which weren't obvious, couldn't have been obvious to the designers.
I think there is a great deal to be learned from what he says and what he has written, but the notion that those people are doing the design is for the most part, I wouldn't say nonsense, but it's simply misguided. He's not a designer, and he doesn't, I think he just doesn't understand the overall process. He's a theoretician and not a practitioner.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what my response would be. And so I'm not discounting what he's observing. I'm just saying I would see it in a very different light.
Mm-hmm.
In my previous job, I was at a company called Alias, where we made 3D software that was used in industrial design and filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And absolutely, the first thing I did when I joined the company was I made a deal with all of the sales force. I said, here's the deal. I'm an executive of the company. I'll go on any sales call with you that you want, open any doors you want, and help you in any way I can. So that you, because you're, you know, if they're coin operated, they want to make the sales and that, I'll help you. And here's the contract you make with me. If you are my eyes and ears out in the field, and when you see a filmmaker or you see an industrial designer doing something unusual, mm-hmm. or really interesting, mm-hmm. or innovative with our product, you tell me. So I can go and talk to them and see what the hell they're doing, how they're doing it. And absolutely, that worked fantastically.
Because yeah.
My view was, I worked for the customer, and the people who had the closest connection to customers were the sales force.
Right.
And absolutely, how could I Tom Sawyer them into being my eyes and ears?
Right.
And that worked really well. So, yes, and sometimes you found end users who were brilliant because, after all, half of them were professional designers and the other half were filmmakers. So
yes.
The entire constituency were some of the most creative people in the world. So why wouldn't they, the best of them, have great ideas? They often did. Often, the solutions they offered were brilliant but wrong. But as soon as I could talk to them about it to understand their intent, because that was my profession to know about those tools, I could say, yeah, but if that's what you're doing, now I understand why. What about this? What about this? What about this?
Yeah.
What about this?
Yeah.
And then I could get feedback and stuff like that. So sometimes we ended up on their solution, but as often as not, we didn't. And we ended up in a solution that they were even happier with than their own. So it's a catalyst to the idea. And so the whole thing about where you talk about ethnography and people going out to the field,
yeah.
that's part of what that job is. I don't think a lot of people doing ethnography in the design thing understand that yet, but we're in, the days are still early. But what they certainly do, ethnographers have been doing for a while, is that they'll go and they'll look at the, when I was at Xerox Park, the ethnographers would go and look at photocopy machines and other electronic equipment that Xerox sold and look at things like, are there signs on the wall explaining how to use things or post-it notes here and there stuck on the machine?
Mm-hmm.
And you'd realize every one of those was a clue to a design flaw in the device that we could integrate if we recognize them as such. And so absolutely, you have to go out in the field and you have to understand all of those things and then bring that into the design process and then not bring it back as a fait accompli, but rather as some type of sketch or prototype that you can test with them to validate and work through to, so you can get it actually right.
Now, in theory, as more and more of the products and services that we put out there are more fully instrumented and better connected, the notion of going out into the field morphs a little bit into just reading off the reports that come back from the instrumentation, because we can have a much more of a window into how people are using this stuff, right?
Yeah, I don't think so. Nope. I mean, I'm not discounting that type of tool and instrumentation. I think it's fantastic. I started advocating, again, back around 85, instrumenting user interfaces so that you could capture every mouse click and every menu item and look at the sequencing and build analysis tools.
Yeah.
I'm a total fan of that.
Yeah.
And my sense always was is that when you build a GUI builder, inherent with the GUI builder is that you plant the hooks that for people who consent, that the GUI builder is also a GUI catcher.
Exactly.
That gives you the Drupal file so you can get that. However, the problem with that is that that doesn't give me visibility as to, you know, if you're using a joystick, a mouse, or a trackpad, and whether how that impacts things, or where you're working. You're working standing up, sitting down. Are you on a mobile as you go? If the on a lot of these web services, for example, the physical constraints and physical context, both in terms of the devices used, but actually the locale of where those devices are, has a huge impact often in terms of the experience, the overall experience. And I can't capture that with instrumentation. So I may see weird behaviors that say, wow, I wonder where I'm getting this from here, and then go and find out, oh, gee, this is always happening when someone's using a laptop, in a commuter train, and that's where this is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just the logical interface with the software. It's the physical devices that shape things. It's the and actually where I am when I'm doing it and who I am. There's all these other things that constitute the physical, sociological, and political even context of locational context of where the interaction takes place. And I think when I look at, say, GUIs today versus GUIs back in the late 70s when I started to work with them, if Rip Van Winkle had gone to sleep in 1980 or 82, having used a Xerox Star workstation and woken up today to a Vista's workstation, he'd be just as able to use Vista as drive today's cars if he had have had a driver's license back in 82 as well as a Xerox Star.
Yeah, he wouldn't be too surprised, I agree.
And yet, and on one hand, the conceptual model is the same. The icons, the mouse, the pointing, that sort of stuff. Of course, the horsepower is way different. It's color. The colors are different. The speed's different. The brakes are better. The anti-traction, all the and all the equivalents of the computing. Despite all the technological improvements, the conceptual model hasn't changed. But what has changed is who's using computers, where they're using them, how they're using them, for what purpose, and at what cost, and how many of them are there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's those types of things. It's change of the demographics and all these other things that make things really interesting. And in terms of new services, the catch with the reason I don't want to just look at existing customers in the way that the examples you cited from this book from MIT, for example, is actually those guys already are using my software. I just want to sell them an upgrade. What I want are the other 10 million people who aren't using our software, and so I can't observe them using our software.
Yeah.
So what does it take to get them to adopt our product versus something else?
So what do you think about this notion that, although from your perspective, you want to not prematurely foreclose the design space, and so you want to be able to present things that people hadn't thought about, different ways of doing things. There's, in my experience, a cost to doing things that way, though, which is that, so the case I cited before, where I had a pretty clear idea about what I wanted in this interaction design, what I wanted was something that was unfamiliar to people. It was, I thought, a different and better way, but it wasn't something that people knew. And I put my foot down and said, let's do it this way, and we did, and it kind of failed. And eventually that aspect got phased out of later versions of the thing because it was unexpected. And so there's this notion that it's really hard to get people to embrace a new and unexpected way of doing things. And so no matter how much of this wide funnel stuff you do up front, in the end, you're going to tend to be driven toward what people know.
Right. It's funny. I was at a talk on a usability talk last night, and I was thinking along those lines. And so I'll give you an example. What's interesting is that it's fascinating to think in some sense that the way to design an automobile was not to make it behave like a horse and buggy. It required you to basically, I know this firsthand because in my 40s, I became passionate about horseback riding and equestrian stuff. And I realized my grandfather would be rolling over in his grave, laughing his head off me because he spent his whole life to get off the farm having to know about horse husbandry. And I'm sitting there, spending ridiculous amounts of money and time learning what he was trying to get to leave behind.
Mucking out stalls and stuff.
And moving in. And what I was basically saying is that there's this huge body of expertise and knowledge that was common knowledge and common expertise that was simply displaced by a new knowledge and a whole new way of doing things with the automobile.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a discontinuity. And yet people always tell us that, no, build things upon what people already know how to do. And we assume that that's a dilemma, that it's an either-or situation. Either you build on what people know or you introduce something new. They have to learn, but they reap the benefits after they've learned.
Yeah.
The fact is that I think often there's a middle ground where you can have the best of both worlds, and you can, in fact, have your cake and eat it, too. I'll give you a simple example, is that there's certain skills that I have that if I go to one level of abstraction, I can transfer them into a totally new use of that skill. But as long as I can do it in a way where I give this, I can help make the connection between the two, all of a sudden you'll get it. So it's something you've never done before, but it's really familiar.
So you have an example of that?
Yeah, I do. And by the way, it's what I call radical evolution, or a better thing, it's surprising obviousness. Obvious, as soon as you see it, you recognize it, but you would never have thought about it, but you recognize it immediately. Here's a good example. The thing that drives me nuts on the standard GUI, this is a way we could improve this graphic user interface instantly and could have been doing so for 10, 15 years. When you go to a scroll bar, you go to the scroll arrows where you want to scroll up or scroll down. If you had just put a force-sensitive resistor underneath the mouse button, so when you click down on the arrow, the harder you push, the faster it scrolls. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Flash of 15 cents, bam. Got a better interface. And the thing is, you can sort of say, well, I've never done that before. I've never seen a mouse with a pressure sensor on the mouse button before.
Yeah, but you have an accelerator in your car. So,
but I've got an accelerator in my car. I can transfer the skill from driving the car to there.
Yeah.
And so that's a stimulus response stereotype. And where the stimulus response follows a stereotype, where the stereotype is coming from some other existence. And so as long as I have a repertoire of the types of things skills you have, then I can try and think about new ways to use them and apply them. It's interesting. When I was at Xerox PARC, I was involved in the design of, well, way before there, I was doing these single-stroke shorthand things originally for music. And then when I was at PARC, a colleague took what I'd done with music and did it for text, and he did something called Unistrokes, which was a single-stroke shorthand for pen-based input. And then Palm saw that, and they tried to license it, couldn't, and so they developed their own script, a different graphical representation, but the same concept.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Graffiti,
yep.
And what on the Windows Mobile we call Block Recognizer. The thing that was really interesting is that even though the Unistrokes was far more efficient, it never got hold. Hardly anybody ever learned it because it had a high learning threshold but you got a payback for the rest of your life if you did learn it. Whereas graffiti was very easy to learn, because if you just said to somebody, I've got a shorthand where you can draw, you draw each number and each letter of the alphabet, and you draw it in a single stroke, and so just choose whether you want the uppercase or lowercase, for which, whichever's easiest to do in a single stroke, you can draw it. One of my graduate students did a study, and it showed that people could, without ever having seen graffiti, just explaining the concept, they had something like 87% right just by guessing.
So it was kind of algorithmic in terms of the performance of the skill.
They had a metaphor. They had a thing to transfer.
Yeah.
So there's certain things like that that you say, oh, we have this whole new concept of single-stroke shorthand. It can work really well. People can learn it really quickly. And this one will work because there's this transfer. People will learn brand new things that are hard to learn if they're convinced the payoff is worth it, and that there's no other way to get there. Touch typing is an example.
Although the Dvorak keyboard is interesting.
Well, the Dvorak keyboard actually, its advantages over the QWERTY are grossly overstated. It is not worth learning.
So one of the things can, I think, help bridge people to something new is infusing their context and their data into the experience. And this actually, well, you had the example of, in the talk that you gave, you had the example of a problem with the iPod's interface being one that's not evident until you start to have a lot of your own data in it, at which point the sort of emergent properties of your data set manifest themselves. And so in your case, I think the issue was sort of duplicate song titles with the word adagio, right? So that sort of rewinds me back to the part of the discussion about a more realistic simulation, because one of the things that I think increasingly is the case is that it's not what does this interface or this interaction do in the abstract, but what does it do in my context? And so my context is represented by a lot of data, and increasingly I have the ability to sort of marshal that data and could put it into a prototype or a simulation if there were such a thing that could accept that and could work with it.
That's a really good point. And there's lots of cases like this. A lot of ideas that demo and test really, really well when you're working with toy systems and small amounts of data.
Mm-hmm.
The rank ordering, if you were testing five designs in a toy system,
mm-hmm.
and the rank ordering there might be exactly the inverse of what you got if you put them in the real-world context with real-world data.
And in particular, my data. That's the thing.
And in particular, your data. So I'll give you two examples where this is true. So, a lot of tests have shown a single-button mouse is easier to learn than a two-button mouse, or much less a three-button mouse. But guess what? Yeah, it's easier, but still, the cost of learning a three-button mouse is trivial still. They're all trivial. It's just that one's even more trivial than the others. But you pay a price in terms of the number of clicks and other operations that you have to do for the rest of your life just to save 10 minutes at the beginning of your, because you're not willing to tie shoelaces, so you have to walk around with flip-flops on all the time type of thing. The same thing with the iPod. If you have a little bit of music in it, it's fine. But once you've got you've got 60 gigabytes worth of music in an iPod, searching and finding with that interface is really, really a pain in the butt. And furthermore, as you said, the whole software interface was made, the conceptual model is that everything is a song. And so what happens with classical music when you have a symphony that's in movements and so on and so forth, and so you got 10 symphonies, each with the first movement called adagio, and so yes, you have all these songs called adagio, you have no way of finding. Or who's the artist? Is it the composer, the conductor, the orchestra, and
mm-hmm.
the soloist? And none of those things are accommodated by this base interface. But you don't find you're up the creek until you're so far up it that you can't back down. Mm-hmm. Those are things we have to learn how to catch. And the other thing we need to know how to do is to anticipate those things and figure out a way that we can illustrate, convince people of the superiority of our design at the back end, but also at the front end. Can we beat the competition both on the trivial toy systems, but also the back end, and in so doing, show the weaknesses of the competitors?
So what's your thought? I mean, my thought there is that it does drive you in the direction of having more of what you call a prototyping capability infused into the sketching process.
Or we need to find a way to prototype the heavy uses of the back end or sketching. So my sense is that absolutely at a certain point we've got to test these things, and the question is whenever possible. And by the way, it will not always be possible to sketch everything.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever possible, we economize by sketching so that when we do get to hard things that require a bit more investment, that we have saved enough resources in our back pocket that we can afford to do those tests, to
yeah.
get these things.
And yeah, fair enough.
And that's the thing. Just don't waste money. Don't waste time. But that doesn't mean that everything's cheap.
Yeah.
But things that could be cheap, make sure they're cheap so you can afford the slightly more expensive ones because you haven't blown your stash.
Very good. So let me try to wind this down here and just ask you to talk a little bit about, so you're a principal researcher with Microsoft Research. You're in Toronto. You spend most of the year there, I gather, and sometime in Redmond. You joined Microsoft when?
December 2005, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a little over, but it's coming close to a year and a half ago.
Okay. So, and what's the flow in terms of the stuff that you do when you're in Redmond and the stuff that you do the rest of the year and how those things interrelate?
So I spend a week of each month in Redmond, and there I spend probably more than half my time running around with product groups and the rest of the time with the research groups. I spend 3 to 4 months of each year located full-time at one of the research labs. So in 2005 and 2006, I spent 4 months of each of those years at the Cambridge Research Lab, working on a lot of things around the home technologies and
in the UK.
In the UK,
yeah.
And then this year, I spent 3 months in Redmond, so January through March. This coming year, I'll probably be back in Redmond, if not Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I visit, in addition to all of the above, I visit the other labs. Cambridge, last year, I visited Cambridge, Beijing, and Bangalore.
Mm-hmm.
In the last 12 months. I'll be in Cambridge next week for 2 days, and the following month for 2 weeks, and in addition to a week in Redmond. So I'm traveling a lot to universities and other conferences and stuff like that, too, just to stay on top of things. And I guess the rest of the time I telecommute from Canada.
So what's your feeling about the effects that these ideas are having or could have on Microsoft?
I don't believe it's a slam dunk. I wouldn't have come if I wasn't optimistic. And in the year and a half or so I've been there, I feel perhaps more optimistic than I did when I came. So I think that there's different parts of the company that are more, I don't know whether they say susceptible, vulnerable, or open to the types of things that I would be advocating. But I think, for example, I'm really intrigued at the impact that the types of things I talk about can have on mobile.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm enjoying very much working with the management there and the teams there. I'm also working with some sort of, I wouldn't know if they're skunk works or they're smaller projects that are sort of in early fermentation stages in terms of new types of technologies that that might hopefully can emerge into new markets for us and how do we conceptualize those. And,
mm-hmm.
and that's just, again, just total pleasure.
So you're doing a lot of sketching and a lot of training other people to sketch,
yeah.
I imagine?
So I try to balance. So I spend some time sort of like just a consultant, a user interface design consultant that happens to be in-house,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to out-of-house. There's certain projects that I've initiated on my own where I see things are really neat, and there's other projects where I'm just one of the team members. And everything I'm describing there is largely stuff that's got is advanced development or in the product sphere, and then there's research projects I involve myself with as well that are right within MSR. But I really do believe that a major part of my job is to the best of my abilities and the best of my judgment figure out how to use my time in such a way that I can help bring design and design thinking to be on an equal footing with technology within the operations and the mindset that drives the company and takes the company forward.
Right. And which, as you mentioned in your talk, this isn't just a Microsoft thing. It's an industry-wide phenomenon that hasn't been you know, the design thinking hasn't been on a par with
it hasn't
the engineering.
There, but companies like Oracle, for example, are working very strongly in a similar domain. My focus is, I'm happy to, you know, speak to the industry at large, but my priority is to have Microsoft do it sooner, better, and more often than any of our competitors. I think that's where we can have a, you know, it's part of the solution to where we get our competitive advantage.
Yeah.
My goal, take the mobile space. Here's what I think. The way I think is this. If we do things right, we can have two objectives here. Number one, that within 18 months of Mobile 7 coming out, that we replace Symbian as number one in the mobile software space. I think that's doable. I think that's worth aspiring to. Second, I believe what's worth aspiring to is that with something like Windows Mobile, for example, that there's not a single one of our customers, having seen what we deliver, that I want them to be able to and enthusiastic about getting on stage after Steve Jobs shows the iPhone 2.0 and blows him off the stage and makes him go away with his tail between his legs because of whereas he's done some nice fashion statement that we've actually shown real innovation that's sustainable, deep, and actually has real value. And I think those are both appropriate, achievable, and desirable results from both just the whole personality of the company, but also the, you know, business side as a shareholder. And I think that those attitudes reflect a design mentality. It basically says, you know, I want every one of our products to come out and people say, wow, that's fantastic. When's Apple or Sony going to come out with a product that good?
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we don't just have that as a given in everything we do, we're aiming too low and we don't deserve to win.
Well said. Well, I have no further questions. Thanks very much, Bill. It was really a pleasure to speak with you. I guess I ideally would have received your book ahead of this conversation, but I think, like I said, I got enough out of your talk that we could have had a pretty productive interview here.
My pleasure. Anytime.